I like being that in touch with a spot. So you're aware of kind of the daily and seasonal changes. And it, of course, it's pleasing when the next year rolls around and things repeat. It's like, yeah, the same birds show up every year at the same time. It's almost like the sun rising every day. Things that you need to have happen.
Hello. Welcome to Wind is the Original Radio, a podcast where on Tuesdays we have conversations with the best nature listeners in the world. We talk about the work and philosophy of each artist, as well as learnings from nature they share with us from their own experience. On Fridays, we publish long-format immersive nature soundscapes for contemplation and to help you relax. I'm Melissa, and I'm hosting and creating this podcast for Earth FM. Today's guest is Christine Haas, a field biologist and nature field recordist. And now, on to our conversation.
I'm Dr. Christine Haas. I prefer to go by Chris. I'm a field biologist doing field research for many, many years. Got into sound recording about a dozen years ago, kind of as an offshoot of some of my field studies. And I just love it. It kind of fills a major need in me, both to get out and to be able to share what I'm hearing. And so, I mean, it was very novel for me, and I think you probably appreciate that sound is somewhat deprecated in terms of how we perceive the world. And so I decided to start a blog about my sound recording adventures. At this point, I kind of perceive the world through sound and my sound recording. And so the sound recording expeditions I take throughout the Western U.S. have been very exciting and very fun.
I've been listening and reading your work for a long while, and you can listen to an incredible variety of animal species, which is already so extensive and complex. But you also talk about hearing small sounds in trees and water. How did you get familiar with so many voices?
Mostly spending a lot of time outside. And actually the process of recording, I find somewhat iterative. So when I first started recording and listening to the world through headphones is so different than listening just through your ears. So when I first started recording and put the headphones on to review the recordings, I was hearing so much more than I had when I'd been outside. And it's like those sounds were there, but I just didn't hear them. And I realized how much our ears and our brains filter out, which is a real important process to keep us from being overloaded. But at the same time, it restricts what we can hear in the natural world. And for instance, I would be, you know, as the morning warms up, the insects up in the trees start buzzing, bees and flies. And when I'm outside, I don't hear that, but I sure hear it on the recordings. And so I started forcing myself to listen. And so when I'd be out, it's like, okay, I know there's bees and flies buzzing up in the trees. And I would listen and listen and listen till I could finally pick it out. And the same with the different way the wind moves through different trees. There's a slightly different sound, so that an aspen sounds different from a pine, sounds different from an oak. And the time of year, they sound different. And just forcing myself to listen to those details, I'm still doing that many years later. finding stuff in the recordings that I didn't know was there. And, you know, even though I was there listening to it, I didn't pick it up.
From what I read, you enjoy your days a lot when you are out. And at the same time, you have a lot of knowledge. And I'm curious about your process in the field. Can you walk us through how those days are for you?
I keep a journal while I'm out. And every morning after I have breakfast and, you know, make an extra cup of coffee and sit down and write in the journal, I'll describe how and when I got there and detailed notes of the area, as well as, you know, what microphones I set up and the weather and everything, so I can go back. And I found those notes to be invaluable. I mean, if a fire was raging down and I had to pack up my car really quick, those notebooks are the first thing I'm grabbing. I often try to get to a camp spot in early afternoon, and then I spend the afternoon watching the birds and figuring out what's there, trying to get a measure of what the habitat is and kind of start a mental list of what plants I'm seeing and, you know, are they blooming or not? So I have a feel for what I want to record, and that determines what mics I set out. And I usually set out mics in the late evening and then record past the dawn chorus in the morning. I find a more pleasing, the dawn chorus can be so chaotic. And so I'm finding a more pleasing morning sound is after the dawn chorus. And so trying to make sure I have enough battery power left in the recorders to run until, you know, 9 or 10 in the morning. And then if I can, if I'm not on the road, I'll try to record periodically through the afternoon. And it's kind of what I feel is almost a gap in my recordings is that period between the dawn chorus and the evening chorus. I don't record as much then as I should. And I go back to the early recordings I made before I started setting out overnight rigs. And they were usually done somewhere almost midday. And I find those some of my best recordings because it is calmer, but things are still going on. You get a lot more insect, you know, the fly buzz type noise, which can be kind of noisy. But things are just calmer and more relaxing then.
About animal behavior, I just started to read What the Robin Knows by John Young, and I'm so fascinated by the idea of attuning oneself to the environment around, and that just by observing one animal or what it seems to be an innocent interaction between two animals, it seems that there is so much information like that we can put together. And through your writings and the way that you describe what's happening in your recordings, I have the sensation that it is also your world in a way. So what practices are there that we can do in the field to begin this process?
I don't think anything beats just being out and listening. And that's kind of the same with knowing what's there. To me, when I go out, I don't kind of hear music. I hear conversations. Yeah. If a robin is singing to another robin, they're communicating back and forth, but everybody around them is tuned into that. So if that song turns into an alarm call, it alarms everybody. So all the other birds and even some of the mammals are aware of that. So to me, it's just a myriad of conversations going on. If we happen to find them pleasing, you know, that's a bonus. It's an evolving process. I don't know if you could ever consider yourself proficient. There's just so much to learn. I mean, every habitat's different. Things change through the seasons. So I wouldn't call myself proficient. And that's after, you know, over 40 years of doing field biology. It's always a learning process. You know, it's almost a system that animals are communicating with each other. And some of this comes from my own work on animals and just covering kind of the types of sounds. I mean, they actually have a name for it called eavesdropping, where animals are paying attention to the sounds that other animals make. So the sound of an animal eating means there's food nearby, even if it's not one of your species. Or alarm calls, of course, are the best example. And John Young says in his book, talking about how sound propagates through the forest, and we don't perceive it. You know, I noticed this also when I started recording, is that you can walk into an area and the birds are singing happily and it seems like they're kind of doing their own thing and not paying attention to you. But if you set up a recorder and walk away, about 15 or 20 minutes later, the sound dramatically changes. And you realize that, yeah, some birds don't seem to care that much, but some do. And it takes them a while to settle down before they start singing again. There's definitely an interaction of animals paying attention to us that we're not aware of, that we are impacting things that we don't think we are. Our impacts go even deeper than outright destruction. The dawn chorus is fascinating because you can have, if you go from place to place, you may have some of the same species, but they're interacting in the dawn chorus in different ways. So back to our robin example. In some places, the robin is the first singer, and in other places, there's an even earlier singer. And so, you know, the dynamic of the dawn chorus changes so much from place to place and from minute to minute. Because there are bird species that will sing early and then stop, and other species will come in. Some species will sing throughout. So it's so dynamic. I mean, it's really fascinating. if we look at kind of a more deep time aspect, we've lost so many species. And so if we were recording the Don Coras 50 or 100 years ago, or 200 years ago, or 1,000 years ago, it would be very, very different, even in the same spot and the same time frame, you know, the same season, just because the species have changed. I think back to on the North American continent when people first arrived, and there were mammoths and all these giant Pleistocene beasts, and who knows what birds, but what must it have sounded like then? So different than what we're exposed to now.
One of your focuses of places that have been heavily affected by fires, but you also speak about fire as a restorative force. Can you share a story that you have witnessed in that perspective?
I'm pretty focused on fire right now. That's been kind of a theme since I started recording. But I'm also doing some monitoring in conjunction with the Nature Conservancy at a wetland site about 15 miles away from where I live. And the Nature Conservancy bought the property in 2000, I think, and have been restoring it. And it was mostly cattle pastures, and the stream channels had not been properly fenced off. So there was a lot of impact, and this is a spot where two rivers meet. And so they've been working really hard at kind of restoring that area and getting as many natural processes back as they can. And so I run a recorder there for at least 6 months a year, right on the edge of the wetlands. And I've seen some birds come back that are kind of wetland-type birds. It's been interesting. It's certainly not as linear as I would expect. And some of that's just the annual dynamics of the water. So in 2022, it was a really, really dry year. And the kind of ponded area where I'd been monitoring dried up. And so suddenly it got really quiet on the recordings. You know, I leave it out there for a month or two at a time and then pull in the recorder and check the recording. And so I went out to see what was going on and discovered that, you know, it was really, really dry. What had been water was now mud or dried dirt. So the birds and the frogs and everything moved out of range of the recorder. And then this last year, we had just the opposite happen, where we had a really tremendous winter. I mean, actually, when I set up my recorder in the spring, I had to use skis to get out to the spot. And then it flooded. And so I couldn't get out there at all for months. And I just finished reviewing the recordings for the year a couple of days ago. And everything seems a bit fainter. I mean, the traffic sounds are louder. And I think what happened is just because there was so much water everywhere, things weren't concentrated on the pond near where I record. So a lot of things were farther away. And some of the species that I had been recording years ago were gone. I suspect they just moved to a different spot, but they were no longer in the recordings. And the other story, which was interesting, is that a beaver. So beaver had been trapped out of the area along the streams prior to Nature Conservancy's acquisition. And they had moved back in. I'm pretty sure they moved in on their own and had started damming one of the stream channels and spreading water out, and a tremendous recovery of willows, and the cottonwoods were really happy. And then as it dried out, you know, these beaver ponds were holding a lot of water, which sounded really great, and the wildlife was really happy. But there are downstream users, pastures and stuff, where people had water rights. And so the beaver were actually taking water from these downstream users and causing problems. And so they actually had to remove some of the beaver just for legal purposes. And that was interesting to discover that dynamic, because I'm just so focused on beaver, yay!
Yeah, that poses a little bit of a, maybe not a complex question, but what is the best way or the right way to think about these questions? Because it does seem right that the beavers are allowed to do what they do. And then there's this question about water rights and how those two are coming into conflict. And I think a lot about how human infrastructure many times doesn't go in harmony with the cycles and the way that the natural world functions. And even for us field recorders, I mean, we use roads to get to certain places. We even take planes to reach a certain destination of places that we want to record. And nothing of that is ill-intended. But it appears that we are kind of trapped in a system that has been developing like this. Do you think we could achieve harmony with the rest of the living beings in this perspective?
I think a couple things there. One, there's just too many people, and we keep adding more and more and more. And so even if we kind of maximized or minimized our impact, you know, just numerically, we'd still be having a huge impact. And I don't see a lot of progress. I mean, we could certainly do better in living harmoniously and respecting the other beings on the planet. I don't see a lot moving that direction. I mean, little tiny pockets, but I think for the most part, people are too consumed with getting as much as they can and acquiring their comfort at no matter what expense to the rest of the planet. I'm not real optimistic.
Oh, I understand this completely. And in a way, I'm also not very optimistic, but I also like to think about the sentence that I hear, which I don't remember who the author is, but it goes like, where there is darkness, there is also light. And so I want to believe that we are able to imagine a better future. And of course, I also think a lot about the roles of nature field recordings. You know, as I said before, even though we're doing something potentially really good, there's many sorts of impacts, not only in terms of pollution, but there are, of course, other aspects of it. And there are things that we can always be respectful about. And one thing that I would like to ask you regarding that is, what are some good practices that we can have in the field? Certainly not blasting loud music, as some people sometimes do.
Yeah, I'm surprised at how many people do that. And I have too many horror stories of people just showing up out in the woods and cranking up the speakers. And it's like, don't. The best thing, I think, is to sit quietly. A lot of animals, if you're just being quiet and not moving much, will start to relax. Some won't. I mean, in addition to being scary looking or sounding, we also smell bad to some animals.
Really? I didn't know.
Yeah, a whole nother sense that we're not very aware of, but other animals are. A lot of the deer and most of the predators, I mean, in much of my work, you know, I studied bighorn sheep for many years and then white-nosed coatis. Both of those are prey for mountain lions. And I've seen a couple of mountain lions, but not very often. And when I was doing my coati work, the local game department was studying mountain lions. And so they had some radio collared, and I had a scanner that would pick up the frequencies of the lions and was surprised how they were there. I mean, I'd get a really loud signal so that they were, you know, not far away, but I had no knowledge of it. They were being so quiet and secretive that I would walk right by them and not know they were there. They were aware of me and stayed quiet. But I mean, reasonably so, an awful lot of animals consider us threats. I've been surprised, you know, birds that shouldn't perceive us as threats, they're not things we normally hunt, but we scare the bejesus out of them.
A couple of years ago, I had this really interesting experience, and I was also with another person in a Mediterranean forest by a stream. And at a certain point, I had the feeling that we were not alone. But there was no sound or any sort of palpable indication that led me to have this sensation. And the other person who was with me also clearly felt that. I wonder if you had similar experiences and what those could be, where they come from.
Yes, and I also do a lot of animal tracking and have done that for many, many years. And I used to do surveys using animal tracks. And I would be, you know, walking along an old dirt road and just get the feeling there'd be marks in the road, but nothing discernible. But I get the feeling that there's a mountain lion around, and I'd keep looking at the ground and looking at the ground and finally find it. But I knew it was there before I could see a definitive mountain lion track. And what I think was happening is I was seeing parts of a track, like the outline of a toe or part of the pad, and my brain was piecing it together. It wasn't concrete, but it was still able to do it. And so I wonder if some of that gut feeling is something like that, that you're getting little bits of information and your brain's able to put it together, even if it's nothing definitive. I'm always surprised at kind of the opposite, at where I'm oblivious to something that's out there. And I've recorded bears several times with the recorders that I didn't know were there. And I had one, I actually went out to record thunderstorms in a spot in southern Arizona. And the thunderstorms didn't materialize, but it was kind of a neat area, and it was in the early fall, but there were still quite a few birds around. So I set up the recorder and then left and walked up the road a little bit and just sat and watched some other birds. And when I collected the recorder, discovered that a bear and a cub had gone right by the recorder. I guess they smelled me or something because it was kind of an alarm. And then they ran quickly away. I had no idea there were bears there. I mean, I knew they lived there, but I didn't know they were there at that moment. And I had a very similar instance in Oregon where I had set up a recorder to run overnight near a spring, and it started to rain. And, you know, I kept hoping it would stop raining, but it didn't. So I finally had to go up in the pitch dark and try to figure out where I left my recorder. And collected the recorder. It had only been out for 45 minutes or an hour. That was kind of early in the trip, and I wasn't able to listen to the recordings till I got home and discovered that in that brief period of time, a couple of bear cubs had come by and were wrestling right near the recorder and making really, really weird noises. And had I heard them, I definitely wouldn't have gone up in the pitch dark to try to get the recorder. So I turned out to be rather close to them and had no idea.
Also want to ask you a very important practical question, especially for us ladies that do field recording and go out alone to these sort of places. How do you keep yourself safe in your field recording trips, both from wildlife and from people?
Mostly awareness. I don't carry a weapon with me other than bear spray. And so I pay close attention primarily to the people that are around. So I camp way out in the middle of nowhere most of the time where there's nobody around. which can be scary on its own, just because a weirdo may show up and you've got no protection from other people around. But so far that hasn't happened, luckily. I mean, I have run into some people who were kind of being obnoxious, but it wasn't either they left or I left. And I usually do try to keep a good distance between me and other people. That said, I sometimes find some security in campgrounds where there's more than one other person so that, you know, if somebody got obnoxious, you could call for backup. I do carry a satellite communicator and check in with friends every night. So even if the car breaks down, you know, I wouldn't be out there too long. But the big thing, mainly just keep awareness and have a plan to get out and try to go through scenarios. What if somebody came up, started harassing me? You know, can I get out of there? What if a crazy wild animal showed up? What would I do? I rely a lot on bear spray, probably more than I should.
Does it work with people?
Yes, yes. I mean, I got a whiff of some while I was testing it, and it closes your throat up and causes a panic reaction because you can't breathe. Pretty potent stuff.
Oh, la la.
Yeah.
I confess that many times I go out with a pocket knife.
Yeah, I usually carry pocket knives, but I don't know how much they would do. An exciting project I've got coming up, again with the Nature Conservancy. And of course, like I said, so much of my recording has been focused around fire, but we've had in California, which is not very far from me, some major fires over the last decade or so. And in 2021, there were just some really, really massive fires. Of course, fires burn unevenly through a landscape. Some places are pretty severe and others almost a nice light cleansing of the forest. But we got funding to put a whole bunch of recorders out in areas that are burned to different levels. So we're going to be having recorders in unburned areas, some in light to moderate burns, and then others in severe burns. And even in the severe burns, the dead trees are still standing. But even 2 years later, it'll be 3 years by the time we get the recorders out, there's already a lush undergrowth. And it's just amazing to me to go from a dense forest where there's almost nothing growing underneath it. The forest burns and suddenly you have all these forbs and flowers and all this new life that brings in bugs and birds and all that. So we're actually going to be able to look at the sound of that and see how the sounds differ between the different levels of burn. So I'm really excited about this project. And hopefully, I mean, it would be nicer to start it the season after the fire, but this last summer there weren't many fires. So we're working on one of the big, huge fires in California. We've only so far got funding for 1 year, but we hope to kind of expand it and work on it for several years so you get not just the difference between the sites, but how that changes with time and how long does it take to return to kind of a normal sounding forest. So I'm excited by it. We'll be putting the recorders out in April and May and not really getting any data in until fall, because we're going to have recorders running, I think, 3 days a week throughout the entire summer into, like, September, and running 24 hours a day. And so we're looking at changes through, you know, the animal behavior through the day as well as throughout the season. And so it's possible that some of the birds or other animals may be using the severe burns, but not in the same way that they use lesser burned areas. And so we hope to pick that up too. But yeah, I'll be writing about it on the blog.
Well, I do hope that you get funding for as many years as possible. I can imagine it's about a dozen or so to have a more complete picture.
Yeah.
It's incredible what you were saying just before about the capacity of regeneration that exists after such events, but it's never really quite the same, right? So even if we have an extended period of time, say for this land to regenerate, does it really go back to exactly where it was before?
You know, that becomes almost a issue of definition. So that, is it the same to us or is it similar enough for the birds or the mice or frogs or whatever that it may not be exactly the same, but it's good enough? So, I mean, a lot of questions we don't know. And the biggest problem we've had with this whole study is there have been a massive increase in salvage logging. So the foresters go in and cut down all the dead trees, which is really, really hard on the soil. So you don't get that flush of herbaceous vegetation. That impacts a lot. So we're really, really trying to stay away from any areas that have been or will be cut, which is hard because the number of mills popping up and the amount of cutting is just really remarkable. So hopefully we'll bring lumber prices down, but other than that, it's a little hard on the environment. And take areas where the dead trees would have fallen and contributed nutrients to the forest floor. Well, that's gone. So it's now bare open soil. So it actually makes the impacts of the fire much worse.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was not aware at all of these possibilities.
Yeah, you can't miss it here because there's so many logging trucks and areas that have just been clear cut. In many cases, huge areas of dead trees are now like dirt. Nothing but dirt.
I'm curious about the difference and different proportions of species, both from animals and plants, that will come and grow, and wondering if there are smaller ecosystems forming. So what could happen in this scenario?
If you break it down into kind of taxa, so you have, you know, birds and mammals and insects, the proportions of those I would expect to change dramatically. So that the areas that burned pretty hard are a mother load for insects when they come in after the plants. And of course, the birds will come in after the insects, but that's probably a whole different group than in areas that were kind of lightly burned, where you need to regenerate some of the shrubs that burned, but the trees are still there. So they're still nesting habitat and all of that. You also have the small mammals, the mice and stuff, and that'll bring in foxes and coyotes and hawks, yeah, and owls. So it's in many ways a richer ecosystem than was there when it was just a dense forest, but very different. And the question now with climate change, the climate is different now than 100 years ago when these forests, yeah, formed. So I'd, even given 100, 150 years, they may not get back to where they were. Maybe they'll get something that's more viable in the long term? That's a big question. I mean, I grew up in the chaparral regions of Southern California, which is a fire-intensive ecosystem. And so it wasn't unusual every fall to have hillsides on fire, sometimes occasionally have to not go to school or not go out on recess because the smoke was so thick.
And just to clarify, were these fires set by people?
They were probably human set, because that's not a very stormy period, but they weren't set intentionally to manage. It's an interesting system that I think is probably comparable to areas in Southern Europe, the chaparral, which burns really well, but it regenerates pretty fast. So I've long been kind of plagued by fire and terrified by fire. So it's been kind of almost a reckoning on my part to go from the psychological impacts. I mean, it's really hard to see these areas that have burned. It's almost a painful experience. And to realize that it's not necessarily destruction. In most cases, it's not destruction at all, but it is a regeneration. And it's just kind of the forest's way of resetting itself. Most of the forests around here evolved with fire. Maybe not the really intense fires that we have now. Although I think it's somewhat foolish to think that these forests haven't experienced that at some point. I mean, drought's part of this ecosystem as well. And so I think at some point in the past, there were dry periods and there were periods where, you know, a lightning strike hit and burned so hot it took out a whole portion of the forest. So I think that's part of the system. And I think it's foolish to try to not have fire. And that's unfortunately what seems to be the intent now. You know, they're basically destroying the forest to save the trees by doing a lot of the thinning that they do. And much of the thick forest we have that was 100, 120, 150 years old was the result of logging. So they went in and clear-cut everything, and what returned was a really dense forest. And so to me, it's a little strange that they're trying to fix it with logging. Even with all the science we apply, there's a lot we don't understand.
Do you have some favorite field recordings of yours?
No, I have a bunch, but it's too hard to nail down just one. If I did, it'd be the one I haven't got yet. I mean, I have sounds that I really like and some that I've recorded well and some not so well. So they're, you know, still on the list to get a better recording of that, as well as other sounds I haven't yet had the opportunity to record. But 2 years ago, so back in 2021, I did an expedition with Lang Elliott. So we went down to Southern California and Arizona and down into Texas. And that was a wild, crazy recording thing, as they typically are with Lang. So there were so many recordings coming in so fast. We typically had 3 or 4 rigs out every night. It takes you the rest of the year to go all the recordings. But there was some really nice stuff in there from Southern Arizona. And actually in Southern Texas as well, down in Big Bend National Park. It's out of all the flight paths, so there's no plane traffic, and it's so far off the roads, and there's no trains there, so there's no human traffic. And it's far enough south, you're getting a lot of Mexican birds in there, in very busy places. I mean, it's a very dry desert, but there's both the Rio Grande River and other little rivers coming in. Tremendous diversity of habitat. It's a national park, a huge national park, so not a lot of development there. And of course, I mean, we were out at a remote campground.
In my own practice, one of the things that I find personally more difficult for me to attune to really listen and to record properly, it's water. For me, it's difficult. I feel that I don't really understand it. And I wanted to ask you, how can we listen to water? And how can we make a recording of it?
In terms of water, I find that the best recordings come from putting the mics right next to the water. I mean, 6 inches away. And your mic's as low as you can get them. So you're really getting the detail of the interaction of the water with the substrate it's going over. And I'm really picky about that sound. I don't know if it's a visceral thing, but there's not many places that produce a really nice water sound to me. A lot of them are very metallic. You know, when you get faster water, it becomes kind of whooshy, which is nice. I mean, you can stand next to a waterfall and appreciate the sound, although if you try to record it, it turns into mush, audio mush. And it's almost impossible to pull the detail out of that. So I find the smaller the stream and the slower it's moving really, really helps. But to me, it's really important to get right down to it. It's a challenge. I'm lucky enough to live not too far from a nice sandy bottom river that changes so dynamically through the year and depending on, you know, what the snow melt was the previous year. So I've made some really nice recordings when it's low in late summer and after a fairly dry winter. Right now, it's still flowing really, really high from last winter, and it's not bad. I mean, I walk along the river often and always kind of, you know, well, how would that sound in a recording? And go a little bit farther, how would that sound? So it's not just how it sounds to me now when I'm there. It's how could I expect that to translate through a recording? You know, what's going to happen after the mics pick it up? But that takes a lot of practice to figure out what you hear and then what the microphone hears and what the recorder does to it. The biggest thing is to get close. I find the best approximation I can do to what the mics are going to do is cupping my ears. And so that picks up a lot of the kind of background sounds that you filter out. And so you get a better idea if you're getting a lot of buzz or whoosh in the background that wouldn't be nice on the recording. But yeah, the biggest thing I've found is getting the mics right down on the stream and finding, you know, a nice slow spot. And if you're recording stereo, trying to figure out that stereo balance. And that gets difficult because it's not unusual to have a stronger riffle on one side than the other. And so it's kind of unbalanced. Yeah, and the stream side vegetation makes so much difference too. So if you have, you know, big trees versus just shrubs, and then, yeah, if you have a rocky outcrop on the far side where you're getting a lot of reflection, that can make a huge difference. Recording water is very difficult, but to me, very satisfying. It's something that I'm always working on. I like listening to recordings of gentle streams, but finding, you know, one that's actually slow enough. So it's more of a little gurgling stream. It's definitely a matter of opinion. You know, personal preference as to what sounds good there. I was in the mountains of northeastern Oregon, and big snowmelt streams running through every canyon bottom with big steep sides. And the streams weren't huge, but they were very rocky bottoms and just made a roar. And, I mean, it swamped every single dawn chorus. And it's like, wow, how do the birds live here? How do they hear each other over this roar of the stream? Some of the recordings on the blog people say they like with that stream background. I don't. That's, to me, it's overwhelming. I actually left that area and went to an area where there were no streams so I could record the forest without that roar. I mean, I would actually go sit down by the stream and enjoy the sights of it because I love watching running water. And you could pick up more detail right next to the stream. And so I did some recording of just the water, but I really wanted to record the birds. So it was getting in the way. I couldn't at the time, but had I been able to go far enough upstream to where the actual snowmelt was, it probably would sound great. But farther down in the valley, it was too loud.
So if I pick from your recordings the same stream or the same lake, the same river, and play back to you in different seasons, you are easily able to understand in which season those recordings have been made.
Well, usually that's the biota talking. So in the winter, you're either getting very few birds or just the resident birds. And then the spring, of course, you have the migrants come in and it gets very full of birdsong. And then later in the summer, about the time the birds start quieting down, the insects come in. And so you get a lot of crickets and katydids and other chirping insects. So those give you a lot of information. And I've been able to, looking at videos, like remote camera videos where they have the audio with it, you can usually tell what season it was just by the background sounds. I like being that in touch with a spot. So you're aware of kind of the daily and seasonal changes. And it, of course, it's pleasing when the next year rolls around and things repeat. It's like, yeah, the same birds show up every year at the same time. It's almost like the sun rising every day. Things that you need to have happen. We need to kind of tune into these things.
You just listened to Christine Haas on the Wind is the Original Radio podcast on the series Artist Talks. You can find more information about Chris and her website on www.wildmountainecos.com, as well as the references we talked about in the episode's notes. Earth FM is a non-profit repository of hundreds of immersive soundscapes from around the world, recorded by the best artists. If you resonate with our mission, please consider supporting us by becoming a member or donating on www.earth.fm. Join us in the effort of awakening together to the wonders and preciousness of Mother Earth.